Then,
Exactly, you invest in the
yeah.
team. Our latest investment, which in fact is our largest investment to date in our first ticket and from Fund Two. From Fund Two, we did four investments. The latest one was a $1 million investment. We invested in the company before the founders were full time. So there's a website, which is only a logo. There's a deck, like a 10 slide deck. Both of the founders are still full time at another company. They're going to be leaving in a month. So we still wanted to invest because we were bullish on the founders. We were bullish on the space. It's a newly emerging space. There's a lot of investor appetite within the space. And
welcome to YFAML.com, the podcast, a place for young entrepreneurs get inspired by people like you who don't just talk about their dreams and aspirations, but actually do and take action. So today we have Enis Huli here. He's a general partner at 500 Startups Istanbul, and he's in charge of the Eastern European and Turkish regions, right? So, you know, with no further ado, why don't you go ahead and tell us a bit about your background and what you've done so far.
Hello, everyone, and thanks for inviting me. My name is Enis. I'm one of the general partners of 500 Startups Istanbul. 500 Startups Istanbul is the regional fund within 500, where we invest into Central Eastern Europe and Turkey. Prior to 500, back in 2010, I started my own company called GoodBuzz in marketing technology space. We raised a seed round back then. We had our team in Turkey. We had our team in Lithuania, a team in the UK. I was going back and forth between the UK and Canada. I was with the company for 2 years. I left it to my co-founder, moved back to Turkey. I was at Rocket Internet for a brief short time here in Turkey because back then they were doing a local e-commerce here in Turkey. I left Rocket in 2013, decided to do my own angel network in 2015, which then turned up to be a VC fund with together with 500 startups. And for the past 5 years, we've done 43 investments around Central Eastern Europe and Turkey.
Wow. Impressive. So, let me just ask you something. So was that a joint venture between your...
Kind of, yeah. So, I mean, it's like a joint venture. 500 has this thematic funds all around the globe in places like Vietnam, Turkey, Canada, Mexico, etc., where they partner with general partners from the region. The general partners ourselves, we do the fundraising, we do the deal making, we do the portfolio management, and 500 Startups acts as an enabler. Both on stuff like legal, accounting, compliance, but more so in terms of giving us a brand and a network to leverage. Within 500, in our portfolio, there are more than 2,500 companies across 75 countries, and there has been about 30 unicorns that sprout within the portfolio. And 500 gives us this framework and the network to leverage all that and to utilize for the benefit of our portfolio.
Cool. Yeah, a franchise model in some way, right?
We don't want to call it a franchise, but it's similar.
Okay, cool. And, you know, why did you get into this, startup VC world? What motivated you to get into this?
Yeah, what motivates me the most, I don't think I have the guts or the courage to be an entrepreneur myself. And I feel like being a VC is a bit less risky, more risk averse. So from just a characteristics perspective, I think I'm a better fit to be an investor than an entrepreneur, but this is the closest I can get to being an entrepreneur. And I love the mission and the impact that both we do as a fund and then 500 does in general. If you look into 2010, a lot of the VC investments across the world were pooled in Silicon Valley, but there are more engineers outside Silicon Valley than inside it. There are more entrepreneurs outside Silicon Valley than inside it, but some have a bunch of the capital. Most of the capital was in Silicon Valley, and 500 Startups wanted to democratize that on the early stage, democratize access to capital and access to know-how. And that really resonated with me. I actually want to be able to see that Turkish entrepreneurs can have access to capital, much like American entrepreneurs. And since this is a global value chain, it doesn't matter where they're located. As long as they create a big enough impact, they can get capital from wherever. And there can be a lot of huge local technology powerhouses that are going to actually give birth to a new generation of entrepreneurs in regions like Turkey. So that, I mean, I probably gave like five different missions, but all of those really resonate with me. And I think that's what pushes me. That what pushed me to the entrepreneurial space, and then within the entrepreneurial space pushed me to turn into a venture capitalist.
Cool. Yeah, we'll get into that later, into like why European startups, I mean, the European ecosystem is not as big as Silicon Valley. Maybe it's obvious, but yeah. So can you, like, I mean, I don't know, just small amount of people get to invest into startups at this, you know, level, at this magnitude as you do. And so can you tell us how did it feel like when you first invested into a company?
Funny, because when I did my first investment, I was thinking that I was actually being a co-founder. Then I realized that I'm only an investor. I'm not sitting on the driver's seat. I'm just acting as an investor. And then more and more over time, while I was doing angel investing, I understood that acting as an investor means that you should be supporting the founder, and not, of course, you help and support, but it's more of a pull relationship than a push relationship, where you're there when they want to, you're not there when you don't want to. And that stuck with me after I did a couple investments as an angel investor. But once we actually raised the fund, we knew that this is 99% an access game, where you have to make sure that you have access to the great entrepreneurs. And if you have access to the top 5% of the opportunities in any region, you're going to end up making money. But a lot of the job that we do is generating access. To be able to generate that access, you actually have to be close with the entrepreneurs, be supportive of them, make sure that you're actually there for them, because they do the risky job. I mean, they put all of their eggs into one bucket, whereas we have a portfolio, either as an angel or as a VC. So after I came to that realization where I'm not on the driver's seat, I shouldn't be. I should only be there to support them. And not just because I like them and I love their entrepreneurial spirit, but also selfishly to be able to have access to the best deals within my own opportunity pool, I have to act accordingly. I think that's a great feeling. From a success perspective, you don't feel as successful as an investor. I mean, say you invested in a company today and 5 years down the line, that company became a $1 billion company. Mm-hmm. I'm sure you're happy, you made a lot of money, but you don't feel successful. I mean, what was your success? You're just an investor, that's it. So after a couple of years of investing, as we saw some of our companies became unicorns, I realized that you don't feel successful. You only feel successful if you're supportive of the entrepreneur, irrelevant of the outcome.
Okay. Yeah, I mean, you're part of the story. You're part of the success as well. Yeah, right.
You're on the stadium cheering for them, but that's it. You're just a fan.
Okay. Okay, cool. You know, I've heard that VCs, when they get too much into the daily, operations, they get in on the way of what of the entrepreneur, right? They should only be there when it's necessary. Do you share that perspective?
Definitely. I mean, imagine at least on the early stage, given our investment thesis, we're trying to find these entrepreneurs who are going to turn out to build $1 billion or a couple $100 million businesses. So we're actually betting on the outliers. We want that one company to give us that 100x in return. But to be able to find that one company, you have to take a bunch of shots, do 20 investments, 50 investments, so that one or a couple of them are going to give you that 100x. And in the way of doing that, trying to micromanage the entrepreneur, trying to sit down and talk strategy, product, marketing, etc. I don't know as much as the entrepreneur about his or her space, because that's his life. I only spent a couple hours a week max on that topic. And B, if I felt the need that we have to be doing this, it just shows me that this company probably is never going to give me that 100x. So I'd rather have my resources spent elsewhere. We're in a market where we should be celebrating and cheering for the entrepreneurs who are actually making it, mm-hmm. but not try to put in more bureaucracy to the company or micromanage the entrepreneur to be able to try and limit our downside. This is not a downside limiting industry. This is an upside maximizing industry. And that has been our philosophy from the get-go, where both from a resource and financial perspective, we try to push our companies who are doing great to do even better. And also from our portfolio management and support standpoint, we try to be there for the entrepreneur when he or she needs us, but not try to go deeper into their business and try to give advice on topics where we're not that much familiar with anyways.
Okay, cool. Cool, makes sense. And, you know, for early stage or, you know, first time entrepreneurs, founders, you know, reaching out to investors might be scary, and maybe they are a bit lost and don't know how to approach you guys, right? How would you say is the best way to do it and not be seen as spam, right? Because I'm pretty sure you get a lot of emails or, you know, LinkedIn spam.
Yeah. I mean, first of all, in the US, there are a bunch of stories where this one investor got this one email, he didn't even bother to reply to it, And then the company turned out to be a $1 billion company. Since a lot of people had that experience, now people do reply to those spammy cold outreach emails. And I do as well. So whatever email I get, or LinkedIn message or Twitter message, whatever application through our website, I definitely respond. But I think the best way to get in touch with a lot of the investors is through network. I mean, this is a really network-driven business, unfortunately. And when I look into the companies that we have invested, probably 50% of them, we reached out to them. We did the outbound effort. And the other 50% came through our partners to warm introductions in our fund one. So unfortunately, we did zero investments from companies that either applied to us through our website or sent an email or sent a LinkedIn, et cetera. I think the best ways, this is a proximity-based business, connection-driven business, best ways to get introductions. But it's also relationship building. So you shouldn't be reaching out to investors when you're fundraising. You should make them feel close to you, know you better. And once you're there fundraising, you have a bunch of people that already know you, that already have you on stage, whatever, stage two, stage three, so that you have more people across the table, which would give you better terms and leverage as the entrepreneur. I see a lot of first-time founders feel like they have to be respectful of the investor. And then a lot of the investors, unfortunately, are really arrogant, which they shouldn't be, because they don't do the actual work. I don't do the actual work. I only do probably 10 Zoom calls a day, and that's all I do. I build nothing, whereas entrepreneurs are building it. So founders shouldn't look up to their investors. They shouldn't be arrogant on the other side as well. It should be more of a level playing for them. That's what I'm trying to establish with a lot of the first-time founders as well.
Cool. And, you know, so we're talking about founders in general, but what about, like, you know, let's say under 30 entrepreneurs, is that different? And like, what should they avoid to, like, in order to be successful?
Yeah, a lot of the risks that we see on younger entrepreneurs ties back to hiring and culture and organizational structure, because they feel more confident hiring people around them, which is great. Initially, you have a group of 5 or 10 people, which are like a cult. They're stuck together, which, I mean, from a cultural perspective, it has no diversity, but from a company mission perspective, their chance of getting to the next level, I think, increases. But once you get to that next level, you have to feel more comfortable hiring people that are more senior than you, that know more about either the industry or the product or the technology than you. And people are less confident in doing that, because a lot of the younger entrepreneurs, if you're cut out to build if you're the best person to manage this 10-person team, potentially you're not the best person to manage 100 people or 1,000 people team. So you have to grow in the job. Whereas with a bit more experienced entrepreneur, they're more entrepreneurs, they're not the best person to manage that 10-person team, but they are the best person to manage that 1,000 people team. So as the company grows, they even mature to a better CEO position. With younger people, they need more founder coaching to develop themselves as that organization matures. And often we see that they become the main bottleneck from an organizational and culture perspective within the company by their hiring choices. And that's something that we have to, we're trying to push away from. We're trying to push the founder to do out of comfort hiring decisions, whether that's VP of sales or a CTO or a board member or even a board who's going to guide and judge those decisions that the founders make. I think it's a mental model and a mental obstacle that they have to pass as they go beyond a couple tens to 100 people company.
Yeah. And so do you guys do any of the coaching yourselves?
Psychologically, yes. I think three things that we do. I mean, I think there are only three benefits that we provide to our portfolio, three levels of support. One of them is fundraising, downstream capital. Obviously, we know more VCs than a founder because we do this business 24/7. So I can provide those introductions. That's one thing that I definitely provide. Second thing, on the founder coaching level, is I think psychological support. A lot of the, all the companies on a daily basis, you're always doing bad. And then this one day you do great, which gives you a big jump as a company, then 100 days, next 100 days are going to be bad days for an entrepreneur. So that psychological support is, I think, really important. And part of it is founder coaching, is building those mental models for the entrepreneur to think clearly, not on the micro level, but on a macro level. That we do as well. I think we stay close to the founders. We want to be more of their supporters and, you know, do these weekly meetings, chat with them, try to understand their problems. And the third value that we add is creating these analogies between different businesses, maybe totally irrelevant geographies, but connecting with different entrepreneurs that faced similar situations in a different geography, different business model. Again, that I think ties to founder coaching, where founders actually benefit a lot from each other. I mean, you try to create more of these knowledge sharing and psychological support networks within founders.
Cool. That's cool. And you know, so off record, you told me the story of Carbon Health. You know, that's amazing. Could you tell us, you know, a couple of the best performing companies in your portfolio, and you know, if you want to get into that story a little bit too.
Sure. So I think the story of Carbon Health goes before Carbon Health. I think the story is important for us to, at least for me to personally, see the mission behind 500 Istanbul. So Eren, the founder, was initially doing an educational technology business in Ankara. He built a company, he had a product, he sold it to his university. He was trying to productize it and sell it, but he didn't have much capital. So he was trying to fundraise, trying to speak with different angel investors, where they came up with these really weird deals. They tried to take majority of the company by even investing even less than 100K. So he realized that Turkey wasn't the best place to do this. And 2007, 2008 wasn't the best time to build that company. He moved to the Valley, became an engineer on a dating company called speeddate.com, which eventually got acquired by match.com. It was 2010. He said, hey, I had this business idea a couple of years ago back in Turkey. It wasn't the right place, wasn't the right time. Maybe now is the right time and the right place. And he launched Udemy. He ran Udemy until 2014. He left the company afterwards. Now it's a billion-dollar company. I guess it even raised close to $1 billion. Eren left the company about 7 years ago, but the company still has its technology office in Ankara. So that's kind of the impact that one person can create in a couple of years, which is going to be sustained for a couple of decades, hopefully, where a lot of the engineers that graduate from universities in Ankara, instead of working for a local bank or a local engineering company, they work for a Silicon Valley company. So they turn out to be entrepreneurs themselves. In fact, from our fund one, we invested into three engineers who worked at that company in Ankara and then decided to become entrepreneurs themselves. That's kind of the multiplier effect that we try to create with these local powerhouses. After education, after Udemy, Eren decided to build Carbon back in 2015, and we became one of the first investors in the company and invested multiple rounds. They just raised a $350 million round 2 weeks ago. Now he's tackling healthcare. Why that story is relevant for me is because you see how immature the Turkish market was and how entrepreneurs had to go to the Valley to make it. But then the sort of the value that they create back at home, although they built their company in the US, is immense. And we're trying to create more and more of these stories. Another company and that resonates with me a lot is a company called Firefly. Mm-hmm. They mount these digital advertising devices on top of Uber or Lyft vehicles to do out-of-home geo-targeted advertising in places like New York, LA, etc. And they raised a bit more than $100 million to date. Google Ventures led their previous round. So they're not, they have enough cash. They can easily build their software team or their hardware team in the US, but they didn't. Although the founders, two Turkish founders, both based in the US, one of them is based in New York, the other one was in San Francisco back then. Instead of building their team there, they built their software team in Istanbul and their hardware team in another city in a bit south of Turkey. Not because the talent is cheaper, because the talent is cheap anywhere except the US or Europe anyways. It's because they knew that they can access better talent and, more importantly, retain that talent for years. Their average tenure would be much higher than any Silicon Valley company. So they have their software team in Turkey, their hardware team in Turkey, because Turkey is great logistically. And that also kind of validates our geo-arbitrage investment thesis, where we're trying to invest into companies who would have their back offices, their technology teams in places like Central Eastern Europe or Turkey, but their sales and marketing to the Western world, to the more mature world, either US or Europe.
Okay. And what's something you think made, let's talk about Carbon Health, successful?
Yeah, more and more, I believe early stage investing is all about, as an investor, you love the problem, you love the team, and you invest, and that's it. Talking about strategy, how it's going to evolve, what's going to be its defensibility, talking about how the value chain dynamics can change over the next 2 to 4 years. I started to not believe any of that crap after a certain while. So with Carbon, Eren knew that healthcare in the US is broken, has to be fixed. And to fix it, you can't just do small improvements on different technology layers. You have to replace it end to end. but the way to replace it end to end wasn't clear. So he pivoted multiple times. Initially became as a became was a software company, then decided to have his own clinics, then merged with another clinics company, then start to roll out clinics, but also merge with them at the same time as well, which made this almost like a semi real estate play, semi technology play. If you're trying to disrupt something like healthcare, you have to disrupt it end to end, from patient engagement all the way to clinical studies and accuracy and all of the hardwares that you're going to use within the clinics. So Carbon story, and we have a bunch of different stories like that within the portfolio, kind of showed me that as an early stage investor, you believe in the problem that the entrepreneur wants to tackle, you believe in the entrepreneur, and those two are enough to build an investment thesis around it.
Yeah, I've also heard that, you know, a good investor tries to find every single thing that can go right, and a bad investor tries to find every single thing that can go wrong.
Definitely. I think the in this industry, false negatives cost a lot and the opportunity cost is huge. So making guesses about why a company is not going to make it and then being right on them, no one cares. You have to be right on things that actually do work. And to have that mentality, you have to see you have to think in a mental model. You're like, what should happen so that this company makes it? And if you actually can see a pattern where this company can give you that whatever X you want to get, that's why you invest. You're not trying to find factors why this wouldn't work, because statistically speaking, there's a bigger chance of it not working. But if it does, it would give you much, much more outsized returns compared to when it fails.
Cool. And, you know, knowing your goal is to bring Turkey, but also, Eastern Europe to the same level, or, you know, very close to Silicon Valley, what's something you think they lack now?
I think we're not trying to bring Turkey to the same level to Silicon Valley, or Central Eastern Europe to the same level of Silicon Valley. We're trying to bring the best in Turkey to the same level to the best in Silicon Valley. Okay. We only care about that top 1% or 5%, whatever you want to call it, of entrepreneurs who we believe can actually build these large powerhouses. And if you go back 10, 20 years, there's a big difference in terms of the resources that Silicon Valley entrepreneur is going to get compared to that Turkish entrepreneur on the early stage, but also on later stages. More and more we see that because of funds like 500 that invest globally, now early stage problem is kind of solved for those best entrepreneurs, at least for those A-plus entrepreneurs. Access to network, access to know-how, that's also kind of solved. You see a lot of more Series B, Series C investors who also invest globally from US coming and investing in Turkey. So I think the main mission is to make sure that those A-plus entrepreneurs can make it anywhere. Even if they were born and raised in Nigeria or Turkey or US, doesn't matter. They have a similar chances of building these billion-dollar companies. But given the limited access to capital in Turkey still compared to the Valley, we feel like we get in better terms than the Silicon Valley investor, which creates this geo arbitrage that we're trying to leverage as a fund.
Because, correct me if I'm wrong, but I feel like Europe is more conservative when it comes to investing into the startups. Yeah,
definitely. It definitely is. And we see it in two effects. One of them is on early stage with a pitch deck, a business idea, 2-3 co-founders in the US can easily raise a substantial seed round, can easily get institutional capital because that's more of a seller's market. But Europe and Turkey obviously is more of a buyer's market where investors actually want to see something, want to see prototype, traction, whatever. So on early stage, it's tough to raise that substantial seed round. That's the effect on the early stage. On the later stages in US, because the investors are more bullish, risk appetite is much higher, they are okay at investing at much higher multiples compared to Europe. The same company, identical company with identical revenue sources, say they make money from the US, would speak with a US investor and then a European investor, and you'd see that the European investor would value health because he or she wants less risk.
Yeah, cool. And do you think there's going to be a time where, because now we see a lot of European companies, now less than before, but that are being acquired by, American tech giants. Do you think there's going to be a time where they're going to stay Turkish, European?
No? Tough. I think the bigger question there is there going to come a time where instead of getting acquired by that US giant, you're going to become public yourself, you're going to IPO? Because at the end of the day, the value chain that we're in, the end of the value chain, is the public market. So we're investing in a company hoping that either it would IPO or get acquired by a company that has already IPO'd, or get acquired by a company who's going to get acquired by a company who already got IPO'd. But the end of the value chain is IPO. And when you look into the Israeli market, they used to get acquired by these US companies a lot. And then over the past 3 to 4 years, doing their own IPO and staying Israeli and staying, don't want to say staying private, but staying sovereign as an entity themselves became a viable option. So we see more Israeli companies IPOing to Nasdaq. In fact, we had the first Turkish technology company IPO to Nasdaq a couple of weeks ago. It's an e-commerce company called Hepsiburada. They did about a $4 billion IPO. I think that's going to be an option. So we're going to see that. We're going to see a lot of European and Turkish companies that instead of getting acquired by public US companies, they would do their own IPOs. That's definitely going to happen. But whether we're going to see Turkish companies start acquiring companies in Europe or European companies start acquiring companies in the US, I don't think so. I think just given the competitive and the market size dynamics in Turkey or in Europe, US is the best place to build trillion-dollar companies. In Europe, they would rather have $1,000 billion companies than $1 trillion company, just because it's really fragmented culturally, economically, and then the anti-competitive nature of the EU legislation compared to the US kind of pushes for that.
Because I had a startup mentor. He told me that not all companies need to go public in Nasdaq or there's a lot of stock exchange around the world. And yeah, so hopefully it's going to change.
For that, we see a lot of companies, Polish companies, open to the Polish market, Hungary as well, Turkey, not so much. We still don't have Turkish local technology companies IPO to the Turkish market that much, but we'll see those. I mean, it's going to happening definitely. It's going to start happening definitely.
Yeah, definitely. And you kind of touched on this before, but real quick, what's the criteria to admit a company into 500 startups? You said you don't tend to get people who apply on your website or email, but what's the criteria?
I think looking on a macro perspective, when we were looking into an opportunity, we try to understand whether it's more of a blue ocean or a red ocean opportunity. For red ocean opportunities, the market size is there. You can actually quantify it. The market growth is there, but it's very competitive. So you have to understand how you're going to differentiate, what the metrics are. Does your differentiation actually resonate with the customer? And we try to get this from either from financial metrics or product analytics. But we look for more, right? We want to see month-over-month growth, unit economics, churn rate, blah, blah, blah. Because that's the space that you're in, we're more traction focused. And our investment decision is going to be driven by your execution capabilities. And the way for us to assess your execution capabilities are these business fundamentals and the metrics. Whereas for blue companies, these are companies that are just coming up in new markets that are just emerging. There's a big market risk. The market might never evolve to be big. We don't know. But we're not scared of competition. If that's the case, we're much more technology and team driven. We want to validate the team and make sure that the team is has enough of a war chest and resources to build that technology, and we can invest much early on even without a prototype. And when you look into our portfolio at 500 Istanbul, you would kind of see a 50-50 split, where half of our companies are more blue ocean companies. We invested pre-prototype, very early stage, even idea phase, we can invest, whereas the other 50% would be more red ocean competitive. We invested a bit later. We wanted to understand all of these different business metrics before we moved forward.
Quick question here. So even if it's an idea, in at a, an idea phase, how do you know that's gonna work? I mean, there's like a higher risk here. Like, I mean, there's nothing. You're investing in the team, right? Then.
Exactly. We invest in the team. Our latest investment, which in fact is our largest investment to date in our first ticket and from Fund Two. From Fund Two, we did four investments. The latest one was a $1 million investment. We invested in the company before the founders were full time. So there's a website, which is only a logo. There's a deck, like a 10 slide deck. Both of the founders are still full time at another company. They're going to be leaving in a month. So we still wanted to invest because we were bullish on the founders. We were bullish on the space. It's a newly emerging space. There's a lot of investor appetite within the space. And, This is, I think, a more of a cornered resource theory where we don't think there are a lot of engineers who can tackle this problem. And there are only a number of cornered resources, cornered people that the company has to employ and manage well. And once we feel that's the case, we're eager to take an early on bet because we feel the main defensibility is the people. And it's a newly emerging market. So once you actually grab a good talent pool within your company, that's going to be enough for you to kind of get to the next level over the next couple of years.
Okay. And, you know, we've talked about, your portfolio companies, what has worked out, but have you missed out on any company that now you see, maybe they've become a unicorn and they're doing very well?
Definitely. In Turkey, not so much. I'm not sure why, but in Turkey, not so much. I think a couple of reasons. One, in Turkey, we had 100% market exposure. Two, because we're based here, it's easier for us to build conviction. So we were more of a risk taker in Turkey compared to Central Eastern Europe. In Central Eastern Europe, because we weren't there physically, although we generated access to some of the great deals, we ended up not being able to build that conviction to invest because you don't actually meet with the team or the founders face-to-face. You don't have all the time in the world to get to know them. You have to make a decision after doing two or three calls. And some of the companies that we saw in Central Eastern Europe now became $200 million companies. In fact, when you look into our anti-portfolio companies in Central Eastern Europe, if we have invested into them, the fund right now might have been, 2x of what it is right now. That's why with Fund 2, we want to push more on Central Eastern Europe. We're looking to get venture partners in Central Eastern Europe to be able to build that conviction early on and have physical presence in those geographies. So if this was an access problem, if I told you that, we didn't have access to those great deals and they turned out to be great, it would be a bigger problem. I think having access, but then doing the wrong call is easier to fix than not having access at all.
Yeah. Wow. You know, this is pretty interesting. I think we've got to the end of the episode, but I have one more question. So yeah, let me just put it into context though. So previous seasons, I used to ask, what's something you want to be remembered for? But now I kind of changed it to what's the plan to conquer the world? You can choose either of those questions. But yeah.
I think startup investing in general, and then VC, venture capital in particular, is the really rigid asset class where it's a 7, 10, or whatever, 15-year fund. You have to deploy your capital, and then you're going to wait for 10, 15 years for that capital to come back to you. And in the meantime, the fund is going to do equity investments into these companies who are potentially going to become couple hundred million or billion-dollar companies. This is very rigid. And I think there's more entrepreneurial spirit around the globe than that. The only way to be successful is not to build billion-dollar businesses. There are a lot of opportunities where you would gladly invest some money and be able to make 3 to 5x over the next couple of years. And those are still great investments. And similarly, for investors that invest into our funds, not everyone has the leverage to stay in for 15 years. Some people might want to invest, get shorter term gains, pull out. But right now it's very rigid. The secondary market for VC investments is not mature. The secondary market for startup stocks is not mature. And I feel that in the long run, either with crypto and blockchain coming in, we see these tokenized funds, which enable funds to be raised using tokens, but also creates the secondary market right after you raise the fund. So it brings earlier liquidity to fund investors. And at the same time, startup investing is also getting democratized, whether that's equity crowdfunding platforms, going public earlier on, SPACs. Those are really democratizing access to startups and for the general public to invest into startups. So the way I see it is we started with this one product, which is this really rigid VC. That's a 10-year fund. We do early stage. Next to it, we have to be doing venture debt. Next to it, we have to be doing revenue share deals because not every company is built to be sold. Some companies and some founders, some entrepreneurs don't want to sell their companies and they don't want to do IPO as well. They don't want to take those bold risks to become a couple billion dollar company, but it's still profitable to invest in them. Yet we can't because of the rigid structure. With a revenue share agreement, we perhaps can. I want to be able to build a tokenized fund to create liquidity to our investors early on. So I think all of these things are going to be different products. And the way I want to build it over the next 10 or 15 years, say in 2035, is that we have these different products that all democratize access to capital for entrepreneurs And depending on what type of investor you are, you can either do investment directly yourself. You can invest into our tokenized fund where you'll get shorter term liquidity back. You can like this reach the VC structure. You can be more risk averse and put money into your venture debt fund where we're going to give you guaranteed returns on interest, and we'll be providing debt to a bunch of technology companies. We have to be able to productize VC rather than scaling this one rigid product.
Mm-hmm. Wow, that was awesome. That was great. So yeah, if you don't have anything else to add, this was awesome. And thanks for coming to the podcast. It was I really enjoyed it.
Likewise, thanks for inviting me.
All right. Well, thank you.